Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. As we gear up for award season, there's no better time to join us. By becoming a Vanity Fair subscriber, you'll gain exclusive access to our in-depth coverage of film, television, and the best of Hollywood. And that's just the beginning. Vanity Fair takes you inside the worlds of entertainment, culture, politics, and scandal, bringing you iconic images, era-defining stories, and much more. Get 15% off a year of digital access to Vanity Fair by visiting vanityfair.com and using promo code POD15 at checkout. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a full year of insights and exclusive digital access. Subscribe now.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I am Katie Rich. I'm here for this interview episode. Once again, on her own, Rebecca, you've really been doing the most on our interviews. It's Rebecca Ford.
Hi.
You have been doing hard work, but you've been talking to fascinating people, so I don't feel too bad for you. And this week you talked to Domi Shi, the director of Turning Red. We don't talk about animation on this show as much as we should, especially since you and I both have small children. But Turning Red really is coming into this award season as a very strong animated contender. And it's such a personal story for Domi that I imagine it was really fun to talk to her.
It was really fun. And we didn't do this on purpose, but having back-to-back episodes that sort of explore the relationship with an Asian mom is like so hilarious to me. You know, she made Bao, which won the short film Oscar, and she basically said she had some leftover sort of emotions about her own relationship with her mom that she wanted to put in a feature film. And that's how we got Turning Red, which, you know, really is about a 13-year-old girl who grew up in Canada, which is exactly Domi's story, and was very dedicated to her, you know, her mom and her family, and then goes through these sort of insane hormonal shifts as everyone does at that age, and is sort of trying to figure out who she is after that, and turns her into a red panda.
Yeah.
As we all did, right?
Yeah, guys, speaking of mom stuff in Bao, just the viscerality of the way that it represents being a mother and that I have always really clung to. And I feel like so much of that is in Turning Red, too. You know, it's a story about a big red panda, but the emotions are just right there on the surface. And Pixar is known for, you know, wringing emotions out of people, but Turning Red felt really different and specific and has really stuck with me.
Yeah, I think the way it is so specific, both at capturing the sort of Asian immigrant family, but also capturing this era of like early 2000s, boy bands, flip phones, like every little detail is just in this film. And I think that specificity really does help bring out emotion, as you're saying.
Yeah. Well, let's hear your conversation with Domi Shi.
I am so excited to welcome Domi Shi to the podcast today. She's the director of Turning Red. And hi.
Hello. Great to be here.
Thank you for doing this. I'm so curious when the idea to make this feature-length film first kind of came to you, because I know, you know, you won the Oscar for your short, Bao, a few years ago, and I'm curious if it was already percolating or already in the works when you were going through that part of the award season.
Yes, it was. When I finished Bao, Pixar had approached me and asked me to if I wanted to develop three ideas to pitch for feature films. And I said yes. And I knew at the time, and this was like 2017, that I wanted to make a movie about a teen girl coming of age. So all three of my ideas were about different teen girls coming of age in different ways. But Turning Red was the most autobiographical out of the three ideas. And it was also like a place where I was able to put all of the all of the like leftover ideas and thoughts and emotions I had while making Bao about my mom. I was able to put it into Turning Red. And I didn't know if Pixar would want to make something so specific, because I pitched it as like pretty much what you end up seeing in the movie. It's a Chinese Canadian girl living in the early 2000s. It's about her relationship with her mom and dealing with magical puberty that comes in the form of a giant furry red panda. And Pixar somehow was like, yes, that seems like a universal story. because I think in that specificity, they did see that universal experience of like any kid waking up one day and just not recognizing themselves in the mirror and dealing with and processing all of their emotions at that age in life.
And so I found so much of this story relatable, maybe because I was also a teenager in around the same time with a Chinese mom. But I do think it is so universal. So I am curious what specific things were really pulled from your own upbringing. Was it sort of the general sort of way Mei views family, or is it more specific things like the deep love for boy bands and things like that?
Yeah, I think it's everything. I feel like for the story specifically, I really wanted to just explore that really unique and specific struggle of an immigrant kid and how they deal with honoring their parents and their family and all the sacrifices that their parents made for them versus like embracing their new emerging self that grew up in a different environment than their parents, that in embracing that they're going to be kind of like moving away from their family and that culture just naturally. It's just going to be a thing that naturally happens to an immigrant kid and the struggle of that. And in the beginning, when we were working on the story, like I didn't want it to be this very black and white, typical story of this oppressed kid with militant parents who just wants to break free and be herself and reject family and all that stuff. Because for Mei in the movie, she genuinely loves her family. She loves her mom. They're like besties in the beginning. They like eat together. They watch soap operas together. So it's very hard for her to be growing up and realizing that she's growing into a different person than her mom. And that was the specific thing I wanted to explore, because that's what I struggled with when I was Mei's age. And even now, too, I think that's something that doesn't ever really go away for immigrant children. The movie was also an opportunity just to like showcase just this very specific world that I grew up in as a Chinese Canadian in Toronto. It allowed opportunities for me to plant like Canadian Easter eggs, Chinese family home Easter eggs, like the rice cooker in the corner. The fact that the range on the stove is wrapped in tin foil. Right.
I thought every family had that. I didn't realize till I was older that wasn't a thing.
Exactly. So there's that part of it too.
Yeah. And I love her group of friends. Like, even though we may not get a ton about their backstories, they feel so layered and developed, and like they each have their own really specific personality. So tell me about sort of coming up with these three besties.
Yeah, we wanted Mei's friends to feel like real girls, like real friends that we might have had in our lives. So each girl was kind of modeled after like a real friend. Miriam is Mei's more like tomboyish, rebellious, goofy friend who pushes Mei out of her comfort zone. She's that friend that your mom would not be 100% okay with you befriending. Abby, like the fiery Korean girl, directly inspired by my real life bestie and voice of Abby Hayne Park. We were roommates in college. And she's just that friend that gets angry for you, who's like, who's your ride or die, who defends your honor, who like gets mad at anybody who ever tries to like hurt you. We wanted, a friend for Mei that is like that. And then Priya, you know, just a shout out to all of the South Asians that I grew up with in Toronto, which is such a multicultural city. But also, she's kind of gothy. A shout out also to, you know, everyone had that phase, that witchy, gothy phase where you're really into vampires and like very, you know, like we're werewolves and that was her vibe and that's who she represented. Yeah, and also it was just a great opportunity just to show how different girls can be, that we're not a monolith, that we can be goofy, we can be angry, we can be gothy, we can be dorky, but we can all love like one thing, like the one thing that binds them all together is 4Town. And I also just wanted to like celebrate girl nerdiness and just show how weird and funny and crazy we can be when we're all together. And, you know, we all kind of had this like mind meld and we're all freaking out over the same thing. Because I haven't seen that a lot on the big screen, but it's something that I grew up with. Like I went to anime conventions for like my entire teen and young adult life. You know, I had artist alley tables with my friends where we sold fan art and we, you know, like interacted with other nerdy girls and boys as well. It's just a part of my life that I was too embarrassed to ever admit and talk about, but now I want to celebrate and share with everybody because I know everybody has this side of themselves too.
And so when it came to deciding what the red pandas would look like, how many different versions did you kind of go through, how big they'd be, how cute they'd be? Like, how did you sort of land on what they would look like and act like?
Yeah, we did a lot of research by going to the San Francisco Zoo and actually observing real red pandas, taking pictures of them, video recording them, and just trying to capture as many of those real red panda traits as possible and apply it to Panda May. But at first, though, like we just our goal initially was just to design Panda May to be as fluffy and cute and huggable as possible. But she ended up kind of looking and feeling like a stuffed animal or a mascot and not a living, breathing red panda. So then we went back to the drawing board, working with Rona Liu, our production designer, and the art team. We tried to capture, you know, as many characteristics of a real red panda as possible and put it into Panda May's design. Even though she's huge and real red pandas are tiny, we still wanted her to be recognizable as a red panda. So we, like, adjusted the shape of her ears. We gave her, like, a more tube-like body. No neck, which made her look even cuter, and just really study different characteristics of red pandas. And we try to put in the movie, like when red pandas are startled, they like throw their paws in the air to try to appear bigger. And we made May do that in the movie. And just the fact that they sleep a lot, they're lazy, they eat a lot. They kind of had a lot of characteristics similar to a teenager. So that really helped as well.
It worked out. And tell me about creating the boy band, because I'm curious how much inspiration, like I remember that time of like peak boy band where it's just like 98 Degrees, NSYNC, Backstreet Boy, like they're all there. So how much inspiration were you taking from those actual bands and deciding, you know, who this group would be?
Yeah. I mean, we were inspired by all of those boy bands of that era of the late 90s, early 2000s. I just remember back then, it was just the thing that all my classmates were obsessed about. And I wasn't as obsessed, but I wanted to be in that world. I wanted to go to a boy band concert and see what they were seeing. My parents never took me to a concert as a teenager. But I remember like my classmates would come back and they'd wear all the merch to school and they'd have a glow about them. And I would be so jealous and be like, oh my gosh, they're women now. Like what happened at the concert?
<They're women>.
And this was just a really, like this movie was just a fun opportunity for me to like live vicariously through May and her friends as they go to their first boy band concert. It was just such a specific goal for May and her friends to have in our movie. Like, it's not to save the world. It's not to, you know, save a bunch of people. It's to go to their first boy band concert together and take that step into womanhood together. And it was just also like, who wouldn't want to create their own boy band? It was awesome. It was a dream come true. We're trying to figure out like how many members there were. We assigned names and roles for each member. Like, there's the cute one. There's the funny one. There's that one that's like way too old that like shouldn't be there, but you know. It was just amazing. And to be able to work with Billie Eilish and Phineas, to like come up with the music for it as well, because they're also, you know, fans of boy bands in that era as well. It was great. It was just another way that we are able to just tap into our inner tweens.
And how did that collaboration come about with Billie and Phineas? Because, I mean, her music is very different, but I feel like these songs are so, they could have been songs in the boy band era very clearly. I mean, did you have them sort of in mind? Were you considering a bunch of songwriters? How did this come about?
Yeah, I think we were considering a bunch of songwriters, but then I remember seeing this article where Billie was just talking about her obsession with Justin Bieber when she was 13. And I think she showed a photo of her in her bedroom and it was just plastered with Bieber posters. And I was like, she knows. She knows how May and her friends feel. Like she has been there herself. So I feel like her and her brother could really help us come up with lyrics that can speak to that 13-year-old girl with all of the posters in her room. And that's what we needed at the end of the day, was just songwriters who could write lyrics that just could hit that generation, like that age group. And we knew it was them.
And I feel like getting Sandra Oh, who voices, you know, May's mom in this movie, would have been such a big deal because she's like a giant Asian Canadian actress and like such a, I feel like, a big deal to get for this movie. I mean, did you have her in mind, or how did that come about, and what made her right to take on that role of the mom?
Yeah, I mean, she's Asian Canadian royalty. And I've, you know, been such a huge fan of hers since Sideways and Grey's Anatomy. And she was one of the few faces I saw growing up that looked like me, you know, in Canada or in North America. And we needed an actress to play Ming. We needed someone who could do both funny and serious and dramatic, you know, and crazy, like someone who could switch between those emotions and tones. And she can do that so effortlessly. And she also added such a warmth and depth to the character of Ming that, you know, that character can so easily go into stereotype, like Asian stereotype, dragon lady, tiger mom stereotype. But Sandra just added so much to her performance that, like, every crazy line that she says to her daughter, to other people, it came from a place of wanting to protect her daughter, her only daughter, you know, from the world. And the fact that she also, like, knew, like, she could speak to that experience, right? Like being May and, like, being that Asian Canadian girl herself at one point too, was huge. And I think, yeah, like she just completely like took that character Ming and just kind of made it her own, and it was amazing.
So when you won the Oscar for Bao, the short film, you said on stage, to all those nerdy girls who hide behind their sketchbooks, don't be afraid to tell your stories to the world. And then you were also talking about sort of embracing weirdness. So I'm so curious, obviously this film also touches on that, but I'm so curious, like, what your level of acceptance of your own weirdness was growing up and when you sort of did embrace it.
Oh man, I feel like I have only fully embraced it recently with this movie. Almost not even by choice,
right?
But yeah, I mean, I was May. I was that girl under her bed with drawing in her secret sketchbook, hoping that her mom would never see the types of drawings that she would draw. I had a secret like DeviantArt account, Tumblr account on the internet. It was just a whole nother world. And also like, yeah, it's interesting. Like growing up, anime, boy bands, all this stuff was so frowned upon. Like all this stuff that a lot of young girls really liked and cared about, fan fiction, fan art, all that stuff was laughed at. And thinking back, I think that's pretty messed up. And I think that should be celebrated because there's so many amazing artists and writers out there right now who are so inspired by and fired up about these like nerdy fandoms. That I just wanted to—I wanted this movie just to celebrate that and to tell people that it's we're all weird. We all have that secret sketchbook, and it's time it's time to show the world. Your drawings. And like I'm not on Twitter, but I was loving the turning red hashtag because at some point people just started uploading scans of their old like high school or middle school sketchbooks and all of the drawings that they used to draw that were super earnest, super cringy and amazing drawings of like them with their crush or like their fictional, non-fictional crushes like drawn from different angles. And I just love that this movie has just like started that trend of us all embracing our tween cringe.
And I know you've taken on this bigger role at Pixar as a VP of creative, and I'm curious how that's changing your work sort of day to day or what you're able to spend your time and focus on.
Yeah, I mean, I love filmmaking. I love directing, and I think I always want to be able to do that. But now I have this opportunity to pay forward all of the support and trust that was given to me in my career to tell my story, and now I can help guide the next generation through the studio gauntlet to tell their story and to help them keep its authenticity and weirdness and specialness. And I'm still trying to figure out the role, to be honest, but I just love, you know, being able to be a cheerleader for new voices at the studio.
It does. I mean, I, like everyone, you know, respect and love classical old animation, but I do think the last few years in the animation space, which has been so exciting and feel almost limitless with the sort of stories that can be told. But, you know, from your perspective as someone on the inside, where do you feel like this animation storytelling still needs to grow or spread out? Like, what are the limits that still need to be broken in that space?
Yeah, I still feel, and I think it's a super exciting time to be in animation. And we're seeing all of these new voices in the space, but I still feel like on a film, like a film industry level, mm-hmm. animation is still considered a genre for kids in the West. And mm-hmm. I'd love to see it seen more as a medium. And growing up with anime, you know, I feel like Japanese animation has really embraced it as more of a medium, and they don't use it as a limitation in exploring like the types of, you know, the like darker themes and more complex stories and plots. And I'd love to kind of see more of that in the West and really, yeah, just see the industry embrace and respect this amazing medium that can literally bring any idea to life and tackle any issue, no matter how dark or disturbing or weird it is. It has this limitless ability to just reach a huge audience and be so impactful. So I would love to see, yeah, just different kinds of stories being told in animation.
Yeah, me too. And where are you on your next directorial feature effort? I think it was announced that you have plans to do something, or is it, where is it in that process? And is it something that's also sort of like this and Bao, like personal, or is it something different?
So I'm back in development at Pixar on my next feature film. Still pretty early on. We literally just started, and can't say much about it, except I feel like with every project that I work on now, it's going to come from a personal place. And that's all I can say about that. But I always try with each project I do to surprise audiences and show them something they've never seen or they haven't seen yet in Western animation. So yeah.
Well, I can't wait. And for anyone listening who hasn't seen Turning Red yet, you definitely need to check it out as soon as possible. And Domi, thank you for joining me today.
Yeah, of course. It's great talking to you.
That does it for today's episode. We'll be back later this week with our roundtable conversation. In the meantime, find us at vanityfair.com, on Twitter at HWD, and on our own, I'm at Katie Rich, and Rebecca
M. Ford.
Our editor and producer, as always, is Brett Fuchs.